This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger. Pull up a chair, because tonight I've got a story that sounds like something a bored screenwriter made up after three whiskeys. But it happened, every bit of it. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, May 28, 1987. The Cold War is still very much alive. Ronald Reagan is in the White House. Mikhail Gorbachev is running the Soviet Union. And the most heavily defended airspace on Earth belongs to Moscow. Layers of radar, interceptor squadrons on alert. Surface-to-air missile batteries stacked so deep you couldn't throw a rock without hitting one. The entire Soviet air defense network, called Voyska PVO, employed something like 300,000 personnel. Their sole job was making sure nothing unauthorized flew over Soviet territory. Nothing. And then this kid shows up. Matthias Rust was 18 years old. West German, he had about 50 hours in his logbook. 50. That's barely past a private pilot certificate in most countries. He was not a military pilot. He was not a spy. He was not some hardened adventurer. He was a teenager with a rented Cessna 172, the most common airplane on Earth, and an idea that most people would call insane. His plan was simple in the way that only a teenager's plan can be simple. He was going to fly from Helsinki, Finland, into Soviet airspace, navigate 600 miles to Moscow, and land next to the Kremlin. In Red Square to promote world peace. Now, here's where it gets interesting. He didn't just wake up one morning and do this. He'd been thinking about it for months. He told almost nobody. He rented the Cessna from a flying club in Hamburg, tail number DECJB, a perfectly ordinary white and red Skyhawk. Nothing special about it whatsoever. No extra fuel tanks, no fancy avionics, just a basic VOR receiver, a compass, and a map. On May 13th, he flew from Hamburg to the Faroe Islands, then to Reykjavik, Iceland, then to Bergen, Norway, then to Helsinki. At each stop, he filed normal flight plans, acted like a normal student pilot on a normal trip. Nobody looked twice. On the morning of May 28th, he took off from Helsinki Malmi Airport and filed a flight plan to Stockholm. Normal. Routine. About 20 minutes into the flight, he turned off his transponder, dropped to low altitude, and turned east, toward the Soviet border. Now think about this for a second. This kid is sitting in a Cessna 172, cruise speed maybe 110 knots, no autopilot to speak of, a sectional chart and a compass, and he's pointed at the most dangerous airspace in the world. The Soviets had shot down Korean Airlines Flight 007 just 4 years earlier. 269 people dead because a 747 drifted into their airspace. They did not mess around. Rust crossed the Soviet border somewhere over the Gulf of Finland, and here's the thing. They saw him. Soviet radar picked him up almost immediately. A blip appeared on screens at the Air Defense Command Center. Small, slow, low. The duty officers scrambled to figure out what it was, and this is where the comedy of errors begins. A Soviet interceptor was actually vectored toward the contact, but the weather was marginal. Low clouds. The fighter pilot couldn't get a visual. Rust was down in the murk, flying at maybe 2,000 feet. Maybe lower. The interceptor couldn't find him and returned to base. Then the radar operators faced a problem. The contact kept appearing and disappearing. One theory was that it was a flock of birds. Another was that it was a light aircraft that had already turned back. At one point, the blip merged with the return from a scheduled Aeroflot flight, and the operators assumed the unknown contact was simply the airliner. They reassigned the track number. Meanwhile, Matthias Rust is just flying alone in the cockpit, 110 knots, watching Soviet territory scroll beneath him. He later said the scariest part was the silence. Nobody called him on the radio. Nobody intercepted him. Just the drone of that Lycoming 0320 engine and the green Russian countryside below. He flew for nearly 5 hours. 5 hours in a Cessna 172 with no autopilot, minimal navigation equipment, dodging in and out of clouds, staying low when he could, climbing when he had to. He crossed over multiple Soviet military zones. He flew near restricted areas. He passed within range of surface-to-air missile batteries that could have swatted him like a mosquito. Nobody fired. See, this was 1987, just 4 years after KAL-007. The international outrage from shooting down that airliner still stung. Standing orders had been changed. Soviet air defense crews now needed explicit authorization from higher command before engaging a civilian aircraft, and nobody wanted to be the officer who authorized shooting down what might be a lost tourist in a Cessna. The paperwork alone would end your career. So the buck got passed. Officers called other officers, reports went up the chain. Meanwhile, Rust kept flying. He reached Moscow in the early evening, and here he got incredibly lucky again. May 28th was Border Guards Day, a Soviet military holiday. Many senior air defense officers had the day off, or were at celebrations. The normal chain of command was stretched thin. Rust descended over Moscow. He could see the Kremlin, he could see Red Square. Now he needed somewhere to land. He'd originally planned to touch down right in Red Square itself, on the cobblestones, but when he got there he saw that the square was full of people. Tourists, pedestrians. He circled once, twice, looking for a gap. He noticed a wide bridge. Bolshoi-Moskvoretsky Bridge, running right up to St. Basil's Cathedral. The traffic on the bridge was light. He set up his approach. Picture this. Muscovites are walking home from work on a spring evening, and they look up, and a small white airplane is descending toward the bridge. Cars are stopping, people are pointing. A Cessna 172 with West German registration marks is on short final for a bridge in the center of Moscow. He touched down on the bridge, rolled up the slope. The airplane came to a stop near St. Basil's Cathedral, maybe 200 yards from the Kremlin wall. He shut down the engine, the propeller stopped, silence. Then people started gathering. Dozens at first, then hundreds. Rust climbed out of the cockpit, and he started signing autographs. He actually signed autographs. He was calm, smiling, like he'd just landed at a fly-in breakfast. A teenager with 50 hours in his logbook, standing next to his rented Skyhawk, in the shadow of the Kremlin, signing autographs. It took the KGB about an hour to show up and arrest him. An hour, in the heart of Moscow, near the Kremlin. The political fallout was immediate and enormous. Gorbachev was furious, not at Rust, really, at his own military. The kid had exposed the entire Soviet air defense network as a paper tiger. Within days, Gorbachev fired the Soviet defense minister, Marshal Sergei Sokolov. He fired the commander of the air defense forces. He fired or reassigned something like 300 officers up and down the chain. It was the largest military shakeup in the Soviet Union since Stalin's purges, and historians will tell you that this is the part that actually mattered. Those fired generals and marshals were hardliners. Old guard, the men who would have resisted Gorbachev's reforms. By giving him the excuse to remove them, Rust inadvertently cleared the path for Glasnost and Perestroika to accelerate. Some historians argue, and I'm not saying this is settled, but some argue that an 18-year-old kid in a Cessna accidentally helped end the Cold War. Rust himself went to prison. Soviet court sentenced him to 4 years in a labor camp for illegal border crossing, hooliganism, and violating aviation laws. He served 14 months before Gorbachev pardoned him as a goodwill gesture. He went back to Germany. And here's the part of the story that doesn't get told at hangar sessions as often. Rust's life after the flight was troubled. He struggled with fame. He had legal problems. He never really found his footing the way you'd hope a young adventurer would. The flight was the defining moment of his life, and everything after it was smaller, but the flight itself. Think about what it took. Forget the politics for a moment. 50 hours total time, a rented 172, 600 miles over hostile territory, 5 hours of hand flying with a compass and a map, no GPS, no moving map, no flight following, just a kid, an airplane, and the absolute conviction that he could do it. I don't endorse what he did. Let me be clear about that. He violated about 100 laws and could have gotten himself killed, or caused an international incident even worse than it was. But as a pure feat of flying, as a demonstration of what one small airplane and one determined pilot can do, it's hard not to shake your head and just marvel at it. The Cessna itself, DECJB, ended up in a German museum for a while. Last I heard, it was in private hands. Somebody's probably flying it on sunny weekends, doing touch and goes at some grass strip, and half the people at that airport have no idea what that particular Skyhawk once did. That's aviation for you. The most ordinary airplane in the world did the most extraordinary thing. 160 horsepower, fixed gear, a closing speed slower than a Moscow taxi, and it beat the entire Soviet air defense network. I pulled this story together from a few sources. The best account is still Carl Friedrich Schaefer's, reporting from the original trial, and there's a fine documentary called The Red Square Aviator if you want to see the man himself tell it. Find us at radiohanger.com. Fly safe out there, and remember, your Skyhawk is capable of more than you think.